Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Everyone, I am Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, seeking to always bring you the very best in Christian apologetics. Today should be no exception whatsoever. My guest today is going to be discussing why apologetics? Why is it that we do what we do? Now, who is my guest? She's Mary Jo Sharp. She's a former atheist from the Pacific Northwest, and she thought religion was for the weak-minded. Since she now holds a master's in Christian apologetics from Biola, we can be sure she's changed her mind. And she's the first woman to become a certified apologetics instructor from the North American Mission Board of a Southern Baptist Convention. Mary Jo Sharp is also assistant professor at Houston Baptist University, an excellent school. She's featuring some of the best in apologetics instructors now. She's on faculty of Summit Missions Ministries. She's an author with Craigar Publications and B&H Publications, and she's recently produced a new DVD Bible study with Lifeway Resources. She's a clear communicator of her heart for people, and she finds great joy in sharing the deep truths of our Lord and Savior. She runs the website Confident Christianity and has done two former public debates with Muslims. So I'm very excited then to have Mary Jo Sharp come on the line here. Mary Jo, are you there?
Yeah, I am. How are you?
Okay. I'm doing fine. I hope you're doing well, too.
Definitely.
Okay. Before we get into this, there might be some people out there who, they heard the introduction, but they still don't know much about who you are and how you got to be doing what you're doing today. So could you go to fill in the gaps? Tell us a bit of your story.
Thank you. I'd definitely do that for you. I have, as you said, I have a background that is atheist, and so I like to explain that, especially if there are atheists that are listening. My name is Mary Jo, right? And people hear that, and they see that I'm from Texas, so they start to think, oh, my goodness, I know everything about you. You know, you were born and raised in the church, and you've grown up in the South, and you just believe this because you've always believed it. So I like to take people back a little bit through my background. I'm actually from the Portland, Oregon area. That's where I grew up. That's where I was raised. And my family did not raise me in church. If you know anything about the Portland, Oregon area, it has more of a relativistic feel, especially back when I was growing up in the 80s. So it was kind of like whatever's true for you is true for you, and that's great, but what's true for me is true for me, and that's good. And so, you know, don't be pushing your religion on other people. Religion was very private, and I'm generalizing, but that's sort of the feel. So I didn't go to church growing up. I really didn't know much about Christianity at all. In fact, what I knew about the Christian faith was really what I was seeing through movies and television. And so, as you can guess, that was a very shallow view of what Christianity was. As I was getting older, in my teenage years, I actually had a band director that was a Christian, and he was really burdened for me. And in my senior year of high school, he said to me, you know, Mary Jo, when you go off to college, you're going to have hard questions, and I would like for you to turn to this. And he gave me a NIV one-year Bible, and it was from reading that NIV one-year Bible that I really had opened up, you know, my thinking to what Christianity was all about and to the possibility of the existence of God. And I actually came around to believing in God after reading through that Bible. I didn't read it in 1 year. I actually read it faster than that. I was getting excited because this is not what I expected. And I like to tell people, I was sort of, as a joke, I was reading it while I was tanning for the senior prom. And yes, you can tan in Oregon. It is possible. The sun does come out. So anyway, I read through that and I came to belief in God. I didn't trust Jesus yet, though. It wasn't until I went off to college and I started to go to church on my own that I finally heard and understood my need for Jesus as a Savior. And that was when I was convicted and accepted the Lord. I trusted him as my Savior. But that really doesn't get me to apologetics yet. So would you like me to carry on?
Definitely. That's, you have a whole story. I'm thinking right now as well that I've met so many atheists who say they became atheists by reading the Bible, and it seems you reached the exact opposite conclusion.
Yeah, I did. So, I became a believer in God over reading the Bible. But, yeah, it took really understanding Jesus as Savior and what that meant for me. And understanding who I was and what it meant to be a sinner. And because these are words that we understand inside the Christian faith, but to somebody like me that really grew up void of any kind of Christianese, you know, that really, I didn't understand what it meant to be saved. I didn't even know that terminology. So after I became a Christian, I really got involved rather quickly with discipleship and then with ministry. And my husband and I, we ministered for about 5 to 7 years. He was a youth and music minister. When I began to see a problem in the church, which was that I saw that the people who were professing that the scriptures, the Bible, was the truth of God, didn't seem to very much live as though it were true. And this caused a problem for me because I was wondering, where are the people that actually believe that this is true and are trying to live accordingly, even when they mess up? You know, they're trying to actually live this out. And I wasn't seeing that in my own experience right now. I'm not looking out across church history and time. I'm just, from my own experience, I'm beginning to have doubt. And what I mean by people not acting as though this were true is that some of my most hurtful experiences were in the church with other believers. And it really shocked me because it just didn't match up with what I was reading about how you're supposed to treat one another, like in John 17, that the world will know he's God's son by the way that we are unified and the way that we are one. And that has to do with loving each other. It's a great love beyond what, you know, we have out in the world. So and combined with my former atheist experience where my atheist and agnostic friends were better, you know, they were treating me nicer generally than my Christian experience. So this caused a problem for me. I began to have emotional doubt. And out of my emotional doubt, due to these hurtful experiences in the church, was born some intellectual doubt, these questions like, well, how do I know God exists? Do I have any reason to believe Jesus rose from the dead? And I started to understand that I could not answer these things. So I went looking for the answers to these questions. I had no idea that I was entering a field, that there was even this field called apologetics, which was a defense of the faith. And I just went into this field to look for answers to my own questions. And then as I found these answers, as I found these reasonable answers for belief in God, I came back around to understanding that there is a God, that Jesus did rise from the dead, the necessity of his being Savior. And so I thought, wow, if I have these doubts, I bet other people in the church do. So I began to teach apologetics in the church, and that's really how I entered this whole field.
You know, one thing I'm always suspecting the atheist crowd is going to say that is, well, see, you came to belief first, and then you found the reasons later. So that's just confirmation bias right there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but what I actually did was I came to a point when I was doubting that there was a God. I came to a point where I had to tell myself, you have to be okay with the fact that there may not be a God. So, if you can't admit that there may not be a God, then you're not looking at this objectively. So you got to listen to both sides of the arguments and see, what is making sense of the world in which we live. And that's how I came around back to belief in God. It wasn't like what I get a lot, Nick, instead of confirmation bias, which I've heard that, is more like, I want this to be true. Well, the problem of saying that was that I was having really hurtful experiences inside of the church. It wasn't like, wow, I really want that to continue. That's just awesome. So I really wish and hope and, this is true. I really was not doing that. I had to come to the point where I went, this is either true or it is not true. And I got to see where these arguments are leading me.
It's really a shame that you're also not alone, that in our family, some of the most hurtful experiences we've had have been at the hands of Christians. It's just such a great tragedy. And when I'm thinking about the confirmation bias, I always like to think that the confirmation bias is usually, I see it as an excuse to avoid looking at the data. The data is there, and it doesn't matter if you want it to be true or not. You have to deal with the data.
Exactly. And you also have to be a real free thinker, right? You have to be able to accept the possibility of the existence of God, just like you have to be ready to accept the possibility he does not exist.
I also like to talk, when I'm talking with new atheist types and street epistemologist types and such, to say, okay, when was the last time you read a scholarly book that disagreed with you? Usually I hear a bunch of crickets chirping at that point.
Yes, I'm actually dealing with that right now, with the Jesus myth theory, trying to show the person that they really need to go back to the sources, and they really need to go back to scholarly works in order to make their arguments.
Yes, most of my fellow companions have already told me, I'm not going to waste any more time talking with Christ members. They're beyond reason.
Oh, wow. That's unfortunate, isn't it, that they're beyond reason? And that's what's being said against the Christian faith, is that it's not reasonable, right? That's the one thing that's really being pushed. And when you talk to somebody and they get so defensive that you have to look at them and go, where is this coming from? This doesn't just come out of sort of like a logical argument. This is what Dallas Willard was saying, when emotions take over and people are trying to defend that emotion at all costs, and so it costs them their reason.
Now, I've actually told some atheists before, I've said, look, many atheists admit the existence of a historical Jesus and go on to lead meaningful and happy lives.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I'd also like to let the listeners know this, and you can comment on this, that my own entrance into apologetics came because I was on the internet a lot in chat rooms and such, and I was wanting to talk about Christianity, which was pretty unusual. I mean, I was always active in the church and such, but my parents thought I'd probably go and talk about video games on the internet and such, but now I was talking about Christianity. And I ended up going to Bible college, and I'd noticed while I was there that this student was studying some one day. I went over and asked him, said, what are you studying? He said, apologetics. I said, what's that? I had never heard of it before either. And so he explained it to me, filed it way back in my mind. And then I'm talking with someone online one time saying, I need to learn how to say something to all these atheists that are coming in here. I really can't evangelize if I can't answer these questions. And so he recommended this book called More Than a Carpenter. Well, I got that. It was pretty good, a decent start. And then I remember someone told me about this book called The Case for Christ. And I define that book as the book that lit my fire and just kept me going. And I really look back that it's a shame that I was growing up as an intellectual in the church all these years and no one mentioned this.
Yeah. That's interesting, Nick. When I went looking for answers, in our church library at the time was the Case for Christ was in there, and that's where I went first. I went to the Case for Christ, and I always say it's the book that taught me where else to look, right, who to go to. So I started reading all the other guys, right? Moreland and Craig and Habermas and Lacona.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about the subject. What exactly do we mean when we say apologetics? I'm sure most listeners know this already, but let's just start from the beginning with that. And why is it called apologetics? Because as one speaker I know said, it's not going up to someone and saying, I'm so sorry, you're going to hell. I mean, why is it called apologetics?
Oh, that's awful. Yeah, it's called apologetics because we take the sometimes we transliterate words out of other languages, and that's what's happened here. Apologetics is apologia, and you can find it in the Greek New Testament. You find it there where in 1 Peter 3:15, that's the one that we usually hear used for apologetics. It's they always be prepared to give a defense of the reason of the hope that's in you. The word defense is the Greek word apologia, and it means, it means to give a case or give a defense, to offer that case for the reason for your hope in Jesus Christ. So apologetics is sort of a twofold thing. It can be offering a case for or offering a case, sort of like offering a case for Christianity, or you can say offering a defense against objections to Christianity. It covers both areas when you're making a case.
It's pretty interesting. If it's more in the show, I usually check the Cracked articles in the morning, which it's kind of mixed bag because there can be a lot of dirty language and such in it, but there can be some interesting things. There's a topic of words that have completely changed their meaning. And the number one word on the list was apology. He said, it used to mean a defense. Well, unfortunately, I didn't see any mention of apologetics in there, but they point out that Plato wrote a dialogue called The Apology, and Socrates' trial before the people of Athens, and he's defending himself, and then people like Justin Martyr wrote the first apology, and it's not going to say, hey, we're sorry we're Christians, okay? It's planning for that legal defense.
Yeah, and actually you get an example of this for our Christian friends out there. You get an example of this from Paul. In two places in particular, Acts 17, when he's reasoning from the scriptures with the people of the Areopagus, Marcel, he gives a reasoned defense. It almost lays out like a case in court. And he does it again in Acts 26 when he presents, he actually says he's going to present his defense before King Agrippa. And then it just lays down sort of like the final closing argument in a lawsuit or something. So you see both in those times, he's like almost like a formal defense of the Christian faith. And it's right there in your scriptures from Paul.
Okay, well, right now we're going to take a break a little bit early because I do have another question to ask, but I think it's going to open up a very big discussion. So we're going to take a break right now. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Mary Jo Sharp from Houston Baptist University and Confident Christianity. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back to the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Mary Jo Sharp from Houston Baptist University and the Administrator of Confident Christianity. And we're talking about why apologetics today. And if you want to join in on the discussion, our call-in number is 714-242-5180. So, Mary Jo, this is all very interesting, but, you know, this could be just big, heavy, intellectual stuff for those of us who are really nerdy and such. I mean, does this really make a difference? I mean, I'm going to use the term the way the new atheists and street epistemologists use it and such, unfortunately, but aren't we supposed to just have faith?
Yes. Boy, isn't that word getting abused in our society. So without going too far into that, the reason we need apologetics is that it supports and it helps our trust in God, which is faith, right? It's our trust in God. And it's not just blindly believing anything. And so, there is a good reason for practicing apologetics. I could just be the very first reason here is that because it is the example of our apostles, we actually see Jesus in the engagement with John the Baptist when John's asking him if he's the Messiah from Luke 7. We actually see Jesus offering not only physical evidence, but also reason to believe that he is the Messiah. First of all, this is the practice of our New Testament authors and of Jesus himself. And then secondly, the reasons for why apologetics matter, which we can delve into today, I would love to do that, is that it answers doubts and it builds confidence in our belief, and then also because it does change our lives.
And when we're talking about the example of the New Testament, we could in fact come right out and say, if apologetics didn't matter, we wouldn't even have a New Testament.
Right, there you go. So they're offering reasons through the New Testament for belief in God. Yeah, exactly. Good example.
Okay. Now, you said that apologetics changes lives. Now, I have my own record of how it did change my life, but what did you mean by that?
Yeah, I actually, for my own life, it actually changed my personality, which was a surprise. I didn't go into it for that. But I have seen a transformation in myself, and it continues to transform me as I grow in the knowledge of God. And I can give you a short story about that, how my family noticed what was going on.
Jeez.
Yeah. So before I really got heavy into my studies in apologetics through the university, I was teaching band. I'm a band director. So, yes, for everybody out there, I am a band nerd. I actually tell people the nerdiness of me just keeps piling on. Like, I watch Doctor Who, and I love Lord of the Rings, and so I can't help it. But I was teaching band, and my daughter was in my school district, and she would come into my office every day after school normally, and she would want to talk to me. And, it was a long day. I just taught, 7 hours, and I was with kids her age, or just about her age, all day long. And so I just wanted to get done, right? So her coming into my office was keeping me from getting home, and she wanted to talk to me. I just didn't have time for that. There's another kid. And this is how I was viewing my own child, right? So one day she built up the nerve to tell me that she seemed to get in trouble a lot after school, and it was for stuff that didn't really matter. And, that really hit me hard. But at that point in my life, I was just busy. I was in school. I just started my apologetics degree, and there wasn't really any resources there for me to draw from, especially spiritually, for to see a real change here. So what happened was, as I was engaged in the defense of my faith, as I was back and forth with my professors having to show them how it was that I knew that Jesus rose from the dead, that I actually had real hope, I actually had real salvation, this began to, well, it threw me into the scriptures, right? Just threw me down into the scriptures. Why do I believe this, and how do I defend this, and is this true? If this is real, then I have a real God that I am accountable to, not just for, defending the faith, right? Not just to go out there and argue with people, but this means that I have a real God who died for my salvation. And there are implications for me of who I am and how I treat people. And there's moral implications in my ethic of how I go about engaging with people around me. And I wasn't just thinking this way. It was actually just transforming me. I didn't realize this till later on that that was what was going on in me. And one day my daughter, after I had been doing my study in apologetics for a while, she comes back into my office and she says, Mom, I want to talk to you. And I was like, oh, man, what is it, what have I done? And she said, I just want to let you know that it seems like you've got some things figured out, that you seem to understand the things that are important. And then she used this word. She said, you're not petty anymore. And, Nick, that blew me away. I was I was one of those Christians that was always at the church. Every time the doors were open, I worked with the youth group. I worked discipleship materials. You would have said, oh, Mary Jo, she's a committed, or maybe you might have used the ambiguous sort of good Christian. But my daughter, the one closest to me, was seeing that I was petty. And she saw, as I began to really be washed over by the belief in a real God, not just somebody I'm professing, but somebody that I actually hold as a real being, and starting to understand the nature of that God and the gravity of what he did, it was changing me. And she was one of the first ones to pick up on that, because she's close to me. You're not petty anymore. I had no idea I was showing her a petty faith, which also shows a petty God, right? It shows that's what the kind of Christ that I'm showing to her. So I was blown away that she noticed in my life this transformation that was going on that I didn't even know was going on myself.
Well, I can say in my own life, when I was in high school, I started struggling a lot with depression and anxiety and having panic attacks. And a lot of that was also around the question of my own salvation. I wondered if I truly was part of a fold. And that's the kind of condition I went into Bible college with, and I was asking myself so many questions and such. And then I found apologetics, and all of a sudden, everything started changing for me. I wasn't depressed. I wasn't anxious. Now, I still have times of anxiety and such, and I can still be a bit melancholy, but everything just changed. And when I read the Bible now, it's really different, because I can see things in a totally different way and think about the passages in a totally different way that I never really thought about them before. You really come and you'd never hear a sermon the same way again either. And fortunately, we've found a very good church, and they're delighted to have us there. But I often think people like myself are usually the nightmare if a pastor knows we're in the audience, because he's saying, oh my gosh, you're going to critique everything I say here.
Yeah. And, part of apologetics is breaking down what we're hearing. But when you see that, when you gain that understanding, which I didn't have before, which is, caused me doubt in my faith, which is that, yes, we are actually all have a propensity to sin. And so we have to live inside of this tension, right, of Jesus's death for our salvation and for the cleansing of sin, so that we don't have to do things. We're not bound to doing things that are wrong, but we still do fail. And so you're like, pastor, it's okay, we're all in this together, right?
Well, one thing we can also bring up that could be on some people's minds is that you and I study apologetics. We pretty much devoted our careers, our lives to it and such. Now, there are a lot of people out there that are good, devout Christians. I'm thinking, for instance, my own wife, she supports what I do, she likes what I do, but she doesn't really have it in her to pick up a copy of A Case for Christ and go through it. But she knows it's important. She says, if I have a question, I can come and ask you, I know, and I give her little tips and such every now and then to help answer a question, help show her the good way to think about issues and such. But when we say apologetics is something everyone should do, we're not saying at the same time everyone should be a professional apologist, are we?
Right. Well, that's not what we're saying. And I love how Jim Warner Wallace from Stand to Reason Ministries and the Cold Case Christianity, it's his book. I like how he has adopted the language of, we need like $1 million apologists, right? People who, generally what we're saying is people who know their own faith and why they believe it, right? Not people who are William Lane Craig and are going to go out and debate, the world. We need people who are solid Christians. They know what they believe and why they believe it, so that as they are carrying about in their daily life, that this is something they are aware of. My whole life is informed by my view, my worldview, which is Christian, which is that there's a real God and a real Savior. I think that's what we're meaning. And then along the way, as you live that life, you get people placed in front of you who do not agree with you, And so you're going to have opportunities for talking to those people who have different views from you. That's where you start to go, oh, this person has questions about this. So that's going to guide and direct you towards finding those answers. But that's what we mean by not everybody needs to be a professional apologist. I mean, we need the professionals. We need them to write and study and do the scholarly work. We need them to engage at the top level of academia and of the intellectual thought life out there in the public. So we need that, but then we ourselves also, I would say first, we need to know what we believe and why we believe it. That's of utmost importance. And we're not talking professional apologists.
I often like to think that it's along the same lines that we're not all going to be professional theologians, but we're all theologians to some degree. The question is, are we going to be good theologians or bad theologians? And we're all supposed to give the reason why we believe what we believe. We're not going to all do it professionally, but we're either going to do a good job of it when we do it, or we're going to do a bad job of it.
Yeah, and you're getting back to the 1 Peter 3:15, the charge from Peter to the group of Christians who are in some way persecuted. He's saying, hey, part of setting apart Christ as Lord is to always be prepared to give the defense of the reason for your hope. So it's not like an option. It's just part of what we are as Christians. It's part of who we are, is being prepared to tell people that reason.
You know, I think also an analogy that I was thinking about earlier today as I was mentally preparing for a show is that I'm very thankful that there are certified biblical counselors out there who have thrown themselves into the counseling ministry and helping people. But as an apologist, as someone in ministry, I've had to do some counseling every now and then, talk someone through some difficulties and such, and I'm sure you have. And neither one of us are professional counselors, but we're still called to do that well whenever we do it.
That's a good analogy, yeah. And yes, it does happen. I'll give a talk on the problem of evil. And of course, what happens afterwards is that somebody who has experienced a brush with great evil in their own life wants to come up and talk. And they need a counselor's touch is what they need.
You know, that should get us into the next part of our program here, because when you were talking about how this helped you with doubt, I noticed you didn't just say doubt. You said emotional doubt. Why did you say emotional doubt instead of doubt?
Yeah, I said emotional doubt because it's a doubt that is not just simply based in a lack of knowledge to an area, right? It's not something that's just like, wow, how would I know that God exists? It's not just born of rational thought. It's a doubt that has an emotional charge to it or a connection due to some experience of maybe unhappiness or some experience in this life in which somebody would say that this is not the way things are supposed to be, maybe because of an injustice or an evil in their own life. So it's born out of that emotional connection to unhappiness something that's not pleasurable in their life, having to engage with that. Whereas I see an intellectual doubt is more of like seeing a problem, more like the way I describe it to the layperson is it's more like a math problem, right? That's not exact one-to-one, and the analogy breaks down. But generally speaking, if you've got the wrong answer to a math problem, if I correct that, then you accept the correction. You go, wow, okay, I see that. That's like an intellectual doubt. You just need to figure out what the right answer, what the solution is to the problem. But emotional doubt, you see that as even when they have the answers to these, even when they've accepted the logical answer or the logical outworking, they still will not accept the conclusion. So usually that means that there's something else going on, like an unhappiness based in prior experiences.
And I also know that Gary Habermas, when he talks about this, he says there's an additional kind of doubt called volitional doubt.
Yeah, the will to, even when you have the answers, you have to have the desire to implement those answers into your life. And sometimes people lack that desire.
So let's start with the emotional doubt. When someone comes up to you, for instance, and we're talking about the problem of evil, and it's, because I think this is the greatest contributor of emotional doubt, what do you do?
And when somebody's talking to me about the problem of evil, and they bring up an experience with evil themselves, they've had an experience with evil, like they lost a child to leukemia, okay, at like 3 years old. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm not just going to say, well, you know that according to this theodicy, we should expect evil in this life, because I don't actually know what the person before me is looking for, and I don't know where they are in handling their grief or in, you know, what stage they're at. So the first thing I ask is, what do you need? And I'm kind of saying, in my own Mary Jo way, do you need a hug? Or do you need a philosophical answer to why this happened, or a theological answer? And I've actually said that, like, do you want me to go into philosophy on this about why these things happen? Do you want me to stand alongside you and just kind of give you a hug right now because this is hitting you so hard? And I've had all sorts of answers, but my favorite one was when the person said, I want both. Like, give me both right now. So, yeah. First of all, find out how where they're at. That's the first step.
Yeah, I've told people before who I've talked about this kind of issue, I've said, listen, if you're ever a minister at a church somewhere and a mother comes to you crying because her teenage son just died in a car accident, if you turn into a philosopher or an apologist at that moment, I will come over and slap you.
Yeah, it sounds really trite. And I know, let me say this, Nick, and I haven't really worked this all the way out, but I know that people are trying to do good. Sometimes they say things like God works all things for good because they're trying to help, but they just don't know what to say. And so people need to know that sometimes that comes across very trite and it does more harm than good. The other thing, the one that I'm still working on, is sometimes I think people say these things because they themselves are uncomfortable in the experience. They don't know what to do, and they know they're uncomfortable, so they sort of give their trite answer and they move along, and it's really for themselves. As Christians, we're supposed to grieve with those who are grieving, you know, and then rejoice with those who are rejoicing. So sometimes the best thing for you to do is to not have an answer, but to be there in grief with the person.
When Lee Strobar interviewed Peter Kraft in The Case for Faith about Problem of Evil, he talked about a woman who was dying because there wasn't any rain where she was. And he asked Dr. Kraft, said, if she was right here right now, what would you say to her? And he said, nothing. What? He says, yeah, nothing. At first, I'd listen. I'd let her talk to me. And too often I think we give these trite answers because we're frankly not just listening enough. And sometimes people don't need an answer. They just need a place to air out their feelings and get them out, and then they're fine.
Exactly. I hear a lot of, I read more of this, that Christians think that they have all the answers, you know, like sort of the atheist objection to us. And actually, the more you understand the nature of God, the more you understand your Christianity, the more you begin to realize, like Socrates realized about himself, is that you don't know much, right? You are in the dark on many things. And that's typical, not just of Christianity, Nick, but typical of the world in which we live. So no matter what field you're in, we know there's a lot that we do not know. The more we find, the more we know we don't know.
Well, we're going to go and take another break. I am Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Mary Jo Sharp of Houston Baptist University and Confident Christianity. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're back. My guest is Mary Jo Sharp of Confident Christianity and of Houston Baptist University, assistant professor there. We're talking about why apologetics today? Now, we were just talking about the problem of evil, and one aspect I think people often forget is if they come to me and they start talking about Christianity not having an answer to the problem of evil, or a good one, one thing I like to do is turn and bar back in their court and say, okay, what's your answer to a problem? Because everyone, every single worldview has to deal with the problem of evil.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that I do, and of course this is always after asking them what they need, right? Because I don't want to just launch into this. Because just like Solomon looking into the world in Ecclesiastes 3 and 4, and he's looking at everything apart from God, just like he saw that, wow, if there is no God, all of the oppression and all of the evil and all of the injustice that's going on, this ends up just being meaningless. It's just the way things are. There's no meaning to it. We all just die like the beasts, and that's it. We have to understand that if there is no God, all of this is ultimately insignificant because everything dies out, right? You may have some relative significance to other people and times. You might even change the course of history, but it's all going to end. It all ends in annihilation and nothingness, and nothing has any sort of lasting significance. So that's a really harsh truth, and it's not something you just download on somebody who's suffering and in grief.
I'm also thinking about how Dennis Prager has talked about marriages that have often ended in divorce when a tragedy has come, such as the death of a child and such. And he said, one tendency that shows up in the marriages that survive is their worldview was equipped beforehand to handle the problem of evil.
Yeah, I have friends who have had that. I've seen two different sets of friends handle the death of a family member in different ways, and both of them Christians, one who had really formed their understanding of why evil is in the world and just really studied. They have done some work on their theology. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to successfully navigate grief, right? But it just means at least you have a foundation for a launching off point for how to understand what's going on. And then another family in which maybe, well, as far as I know, did not spend very much time in thinking through these, like your show says, deep waters, not navigating this. So when it hit them, they don't have any resources. They don't know why this would happen. They never even thought about it. And it hits them so hard that they begin to say, wow, there can't be a God because this kind of stuff wouldn't happen.
One resource I think Christians have often overlooked, and when they haven't overlooked, they've sometimes abused it by treating it like a medicine cabinet of sorts, but something we should pay attention to is the Psalms, because usually whatever you're going through, you can find a place where the psalmist agrees with you. A few months ago, I read N.T. Wright's book, The Case for the Psalms, and so I'm thinking, wow, I gotta go for the Psalms again and take a look. So every night before I go to bed, I read a few verses of a psalm and just think about it as much as I can before I go to sleep. And past few nights, I'd finished reading Psalm 42 and Psalm 43 about, why aren't I focusing on you despite my emotions creeping in? Where are you in such and such? And I was like, you know, this is kind of hitting with what I'm going through right now. And the psalmist is just head on. He's speaking exactly what I'm going to say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting you brought that up. My husband just plopped that book down in front of my face a couple weeks ago. It was like, hey, check this out. I haven't read it yet, so now I'm really interested to read it. But yeah, this is along the lines of what C.S. Lewis had to say with about how faith is, well, in the Christian life, is about you have to maintenance your beliefs, right? You actually have to continually do prayer and meeting with other people and checking out your ideas and reading the scriptures because of the fact that no belief will stay in the mind. It doesn't just stay active in the mind once you accept it. You actually have to do some maintenance work on these things. And then he makes the statement, you know, are most Christians argued out of the faith. He says, if you look like at 100 Christians, So were they argued out of the faith? No, they just simply fall away, is what he concludes. And that's from not actually engaging what you believe and doing sort of that maintenance work that beliefs in general need, no matter what it is you believe. You have to actively engage them or you lose them.
Something I also have noticed about the Psalms as I've been going through them is that I told Allie this a few nights ago. I said, I think the psalmist, if he was in our church services, he would be classified as unspiritual and unchristian. Because so many times he goes and he makes demands of God, he raises these angry questions of God, and he says, God, do this for me, or else I won't be able to such and such. And he's not saying, God, do this for me for your glory. Sometimes it can seem his reasons can be very selfish. You know, so, you know, most Christians would say, oh, he's not being spiritual or Christian enough, but it's right there in Scripture, and obviously God wants us to have it for some reason.
Yeah, good point. And that's actually a very important point, because with the new atheist movement, I tend to think that if you would just look at what they say and you didn't actually read the Bible, you would think that Christianity is like icing, like buttercream frosting or something. Everything's supposed to be happy-go-lucky, willy-nilly, and blind belief, and da-da-da. And that's not actually what's going on there. You look at the Scriptures and you see people struggling to make sense of life. You see that it matches the experience that we have in this life, the depths of their suffering, the pain, their questioning, their doubt. And that's what you see in Ecclesiastes. You see it in the Psalms, crying out, saying, I don't understand this. And not always getting an answer, right? Not always. Paul, and his thorn in the flesh, he didn't get an answer to that. Mm-hmm. So it really does match the experience that we have and offers, you know, answers and solutions. And it's like, that's one of the things I think is really important, is it does match the depth of the human experience.
You know, when you were talking about the new atheist movement, I was thinking about how G.K. Chesterton said that Christianity is attacked for being two different things at once, because you were using the example of him being happy, lovey-dovey, life is good, let's all do a thing. And then, at the same time, it's condemned because Christians are supposed to believe they're miserable, wretched sinners who don't do anything, and Christians are meek and mild, and then Christians are constantly judging everyone and shoving their beliefs down everyone's throats. And Chesterton looked at him and said, it's accused of being the opposite things every single time. How can this be?
You're right. That is true. There's that other side to the new atheist argument, which is we are condemning and judgmental and, you know, all of that stuff. And, it is a very interesting point you brought up. Yay for Chesterton.
Yeah. But, you know, you also said that most Christians, you think, aren't argued out of their beliefs. I'm sure there are a lot of new atheist types out there who would hear and say, well, I got to argue on my beliefs because I went in, I looked for the evidence, and it just isn't there.
Right, yeah, we could just blow up this show to, like, the whole day if we started going through all the evidence. But in that Bertrand Russell's Not Enough Evidence God, that's his original statement, and I'm trying not to sound trite, so if there's an atheist listening to the show, I don't mean to sound trite, but we also have to look at, like, what I would say to him was, what is your motivation for looking at the evidence? What are you trying to get at? What are you trying to prove? Are you trying to disprove God? Are you trying to prove God? What's going on? So whereas we're attacked for confirmation bias, are you looking at your own motives? Do you have confirmation bias? I know that I got to the point where I said, if this isn't real, I don't want to follow it. I don't want to profess it. I just can't. And my conclusion was that atheism was not deep enough to handle the human experience. It lacked the depth of the human experience. It did not match up to things like, why is there evil, pain, and suffering in the world? It didn't answer that. So that's what I would have to say in response. And then, of course, go through, if they wanted to go through some evidence.
Now, you were talking about emotional doubt, right? That's how we got in the form of either. And I know that Gary Habermas has said numerous times that usually you can recognize an emotional doubter by two words. What if?
Oh, interesting, yeah. I usually recognize emotional doubters by the fact that they've accepted, well, there's a couple ways. Either they've accepted your argument, like, okay, Jesus is not a pagan myth, and that was their reason for leaving the faith, and then they won't move into looking like, well, now I need to really see, you know, if I can trust in Jesus. If they just refuse to do that next step. And the other one was, I always tell people, think of a person who will not reason with you, and the person who gets defensive when it comes to discussion about God, especially when they use a ton of negatively charged wording. I find that all over the internet. It's like not just making an argument for atheism, but along the way having to negatively charge the wording, so there's a ton of ad hominem and poisoning the well going on. That's when I tend to go, well, maybe I've got an emotional objector here.
Yeah, I lived with a roommate before I got married, and he's big into apologetics, too, and we had someone come over and visit us regularly who was an atheist agnostic, and sometimes he'd come over for a good game night with us and such, and I remember one time we were talking to him, and he was sitting in our living room, and he was talking about how, oh, my doubt, it's not emotional, it's all intellectual, I just have all these questions. And I was thinking about him, and my mind was immediately saying, emotional doubt, emotional doubt, emotional doubt. And I could tell it was, because it'd be the most bizarre objection I could hear that would be coming out.
Yeah. I want to start with, do you believe in God? Is there a good reason to believe in God? Let's just start there and start looking at the arguments for and against. It's like the God and cosmology debate that just happened. You know, does the universe have a beginning? Is it eternal? Let's look at these things, right? So when we start getting off onto these weird objections that assume the scriptures are true in order to make the objection, then we got to wonder what's going on.
Well, what about your own self? Because I'm sure every now and then you still have those times where evil pushes in or something like that, and there can be that emotional doubt popping in. What do you do then?
Oh, yeah, definitely. A person that tells you, I've only met like one person in my life that said, wow, I've never had any doubt. Most of the time, people doubt. It's a common thing, by the way. I want whoever's listening, whether you are identifying yourself as a Christian, Muslim, atheist, whatever, you're human, and you need to understand that doubt is common amongst humans. Because of our limited mind, right? We just don't know everything. So, yeah, I have doubts, too. And one of the things that I do, I have an education background. I taught band, is that I don't want to ever stop learning, right? I don't want to just commit to, you know, oh, this is the answer, and I'm done. I can always learn new things. And when I say that in association with doubt is that I need to keep learning. I need to keep pressing on in what I know, and because that helps me answer those doubts along the way. But also, I'm a Christian, and I understand that doubt is not always just this intellectual, rational pursuit. Like we've been talking about, sometimes it's an emotional doubt. And so for me, it is vitally important to be routinely practicing the spiritual disciplines. Like you mentioned, reading the Psalms at night. For me, it's praying when I'm not praying, and not just to pray over the food or to pray to get something, but not just actually praying. And sort of like I've been saying, praying the hours, which is just in the morning, at noon, before dinner, before I go to bed, sort of regulating my life. When I'm not doing that, my life tends to try to, you know, it starts to get crazy, and the emotions start to take over. So I need a reminder, back to what C.S. Lewis is saying, I need to maintenance what it is that I believe. I need to go back to that spiritual side of things as well and get that in an orderly fashion, because what is happening is I'm kind of spinning out of control. And I know I'm saying a lot of this, but your friends, your Christian friends, or even your atheist friends can check, your atheist friends can kind of keep you in check on your beliefs and things, but your Christian friends are there to sort of hold you to an accountability. And it's very important that we have people around us that we are open to for constructive criticism. And I say constructive because you don't always just want to be getting those attacks. You also want people who love you and care for you personally, and you can trust them to help you to criticize your doubts, right? Like Dallas Willard again said, You need to be ready not only to believe your doubts, but to also doubt your doubts. He actually said, you should not only believe your doubts and doubt your beliefs, but you should doubt your doubts and believe your beliefs. Then you know you're okay. I love that.
You know, I was thinking when you talk about how you met only one person who said, "I've never doubted." Gary Habermas says in his talks about doubt, talk about how in all his time he says, "I've only got two people on my list of never doubted." And he says, actually, it says liar at the top of it.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know this person's inner life, but yeah, it's very, that's one thing that needs to be sort of out there, right? With the new atheists coming after us, like, we're all a bunch of people, we got this plan, and we're all going to shove it down your throat. It's not really like that. We're people like you, and we're trying to figure things out. And along the way, we do have doubts, just like, you know, C.S. Lewis said that when he was an atheist at times, he had doubts about his atheism. The Christian religion looked awfully, you know, true. It looked like it was something that he should check out.
In fact, you can even read in Bart Ehrman's book on the problem of evil, where he said there were times in the past when he woke up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat because he was scared Christianity could be true.
Yeah. I mean, we have to sort of be honest about this instead of dividing the lines and say, oh, you're over there on the atheist side and I'm over here on the Christian side. We're all on the human side, so entailed in human is going to be doubt. And the church needs to be a place where people can safely express those doubts and safely explore the answers to those doubts. That's what's important. That's a major important thing for the church to incorporate into their teaching, is that, you know, it's okay. You're not some kind of heretic. You're not some kind of weird person if you have doubt. And this is common, and we want to help you through this. And there's a great example of that, Nick, in the New Testament, which just shocked me when I came to understand. And Gary talks about this story of John the Baptist and his doubt, and how here you have in the Christian narrative, you've got a man who himself is the prophesied messenger of the Messiah, right? He's prophesied about his coming, John the Baptist, mm-hmm. messenger of the Messiah. And John the Baptist, when he experiences great evil in his life, when things aren't turning out the way he thought they would turn out, right? Jesus is not coming to save him out of Herod's prison. Mm-hmm. When things go wrong, he says he sends his disciples to Jesus to say, hey, are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another? And that's where we see Jesus giving him evidence and reason that he is the Messiah. So,
and for all interested in my evidence and reason, I recommend listening to last week's show when we had Craig Evans on, and he pointed out that Jesus pointed to a statement found directly in the Dead Sea Scrolls to show who he was.
Oh, from Isaiah, yeah. Yeah, he did. He pointed back there.
And I also find it interesting that Jesus didn't condemn John the Baptist for doubting. In fact, he turned to the crowd and praised John the Baptist right after that.
Isn't that awesome? See, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we focused on doubting Thomas and the chastising that Thomas got, but look at how Thomas gets chastised. Thomas says, unless you provide the evidence that I demand, I will never believe. Sounds a little bit Bertrand Russell, you know, or Carl Sagan, mm-hmm. shining across the stars. It's the show me the money argument. Okay, so we've mm-hmm. got a heart problem. We have a motive problem. But then you look at John the Baptist. John the Baptist is suffering. Life didn't turn out how he wanted. And he just wants to know, are you really the Messiah? Because this isn't what I thought it was going to be. And Jesus turns around, shows his disciples who he is, and then says, among those born of women, so among humans, none is greater than John. He supports the integrity of John's character in front of the audience, even though John's questioning him as the Messiah.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break before we ask any more questions. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Mary Jo Sharp of Houston Baptist University and Confident Christianity. We'll be back after this.
Check out DYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com,
home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back. We're talking about Why Apologetics with Mary Jo Sharp. It's an interesting discussion going on, but if you're here and you want to hear another interesting discussion next week, I think we'll be able to provide that. My guest next week will be Daryl Bach, and we'll be talking about the writings of Luke in the New Testament and their reference, their importance to Christian apologetics. So tune in next week and hear Daryl Bach. Now, we're talking about doubt, and something that I've told people when they doubt, I want to congratulate them a lot of times. I've told my men's group at church, I've said, if I meet someone who says they've never doubted Christianity, I know I'm talking to someone who's not taking their faith seriously. I want to meet the doubters, because those are people to whom it matters. They want to know it's true.
Yeah, that's a good point. When I talk to a group of people and I say, I believe Christianity because it is true, that really throws them for a loop, right? And I often wondered, what have we done in the church that's caused people to react that way, that's what is true, you know? And yes, it is true. And it's hard, like Peter Kreft likes to say, you know, truth is easy to define and very hard to find. And so it's natural for us to have doubts at times because of the fact that it is difficult to find.
You know, it's important really to mention that we should believe this only because it's true, because too much of what we have today is the idea that you should believe Christianity because it'll make you happy, because you'll find joy in it, because it'll help you be a good person. And yeah, those are all fine things in themselves, but none of them equals a reason to believe Christianity.
Right. If we're going to worship something as sentient, rational human beings, if we're going to find that there is something out there worthy of worship, we are looking not only for something that is true, because it has to be true, but then therefore that is the giver of reality, the giver of truth. That would be the only thing worthy of the worship and trust of rational beings like ourselves, of sentient beings that think through these things, right? It can't be somebody that is like the pagan gods, that is a creation of our minds, that's equal or lesser in ethics and understanding of the world than a human being, right? So that's an important thing to point out, important aspect.
I was listening to this week's Unbelievable podcast today, because Unbelievable is one show I always try to listen to, and he had the atheist on there talking about his journey into atheism and exploring other religions and such, and he said, and I just came to the end and found that you can be a good person without believing in anything else. And I'm thinking, that's not the point. That's not the point.
I would say, yes, I agree you can be a good person. Now, where are you getting good from?
Exactly. So when we're talking about these kinds of doubts also, now, we've talked about emotional doubt. Let's get into a little bit about volitional doubt. There are people out there who, frankly, I am convinced, not only don't believe, not only have strong emotional reasons for not wanting to believe, they simply don't want to believe that even if Christ himself appeared to them, they'd find some way to explain it away. What do we do with these kinds of people?
Yeah, volitional doubt is, I'm like you, you know, I sort of discovered this when I read The Thomas Factor by Gary Habermas, which I want to point out is available completely online. So if you Google The Thomas Factor, Gary Habermas, you can check this out. But volitional doubt for me is sort of a new thing. I didn't really consider that there are people out there that just may not want it to be true or may not desire for it to be true. And I would imagine this is very hard to get at, because, I mean, how honest you have to be to actually say something like, if there's a God and Jesus is the way, I mean, I don't know if I even want that to be true. I think that would be a very hard thing to get at. Now, how do we move past that? Well, with volitional doubt, it seems to be like maybe we could treat this, and again, I'm just now encountering volitional doubt as a thought and as a, in my own mind, a concept in my own mind that I hadn't really spent a lot of time with. But it might be, something that we look at, like we look at apathy. Well, what is it that matters to that person? You know, what matters to you? Is it in the environment? Is it justice? What is it that matters to you? Well, how do you establish the grounding for that? You have to get back to the foundation of, like, what you believe is not established by, belief in atheism. You believe humans have rights. Well, where are you getting that from? To maybe help them move from that volitional doubt out of that, I'm not even sure if that would work, Nick, but it's sort of like how I might deal with a person who's apathetic about their beliefs. It's like, what is it that you care about? Now let's see if there's any basis for believing that those things have a grounding anywhere.
I'm thinking about Peter Boghossian right now, and this is one of my favorite sections to read in his book because it really demonstrates a mindset that I think exemplifies this, where he says, if they've asked me what it would take for me to believe, I'll use a variation of American physicist Lawrence Krauss's example in his debate with William Lane Craig. If I walked outside at night and all of the stars were organized to read, I am God communicating with you, believe in me, and every human being worldwide witnessed this in their native language, this would be suggestive. And then he says in parentheses, but far from conclusive, as it's a perception and could be a delusion. And I look at that and I think, well, that's very interesting because here what I tell you is if you don't want me to believe, well, give me a better explanation of the data that explains the rise of a Christian church and a person of Jesus other than the resurrection. You give me a better explanation, okay, I'll go with that. And here with Boghossian, I'm seeing I have to have a unique experience, which tells me at that point, okay, I might as well not even bother giving the evidence because you've already decided it's not going to be true.
Yeah, I wonder if that would work out for their scientific experiments, right? You don't use anything from the past. We want this unique experience. This sort of lends itself towards the show me the money argument. And the problem is we've seen in history that something can happen, something can take place, like Jesus can do a miracle in front of a crowd, or Jesus can speak with the authority that no one else speaks with on his teaching about God, and people walk away. I mean, the show me the money argument does not work. We've seen it not work in history. In fact, okay, if you want to, that's 2,000 years ago. Let's try closer. The Holocaust. There are people today that would deny the Holocaust is something that happened. And we have pictures of it. We have evidence of it. We have writings about it. We have people who went to war to fight, for this, and yet we'll still have people say, I'm not even sure that that actually happened. So, in fact, the show me the money argument does not necessarily work.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes wonder if maybe some of it could be that a lot of atheists, especially things like the teenage atheists on YouTube and such, have already been taught to think that if you believe in God or religion or anything of that sort, well, you're just stupid and weak-minded and you don't know how to think for yourself, and so they can't even open themselves up to the evidence because if they start to think there's a God, well, they're stupid, they're weak-minded, they don't think for themselves, etc.
Right, exactly. This is sort of what my view was before, in that I thought Christianity was sort of a crutch for those people who needed it, but I didn't need it because I was smart. And, I mean, this is what I was thinking. I think it's like back to Chesterton. Free thought means being able to look at the possibilities, right? It's being open to the different possibilities. And I don't remember where it's from, but he said there is a thought that shuts down free thought. And, this is this idea that this is not exactly what he's referencing, but when you say the only way to be a free thinker is to cut out belief in God as a possibility, well, you've cut something out of your ability to think through. That's not free thought. That is closing people off to the considerations before they even have a chance to really encounter it. And that's not liberating thought. That is closed-mindedness.
I always find it so incredible when these people talk to me and they say, but you believe in God? You know there's no evidence whatsoever, right? And I'm just stunned because I think, you think every single person out there who believes God exists just believes blindly without evidence. I don't deny a lot of people sadly do, but I say, look, let's look over the great thinkers of history. Let's look at Plato and Aristotle and Augustine and Anselm and Aquinas and several others. And tell me, you're going to say that these people, they were smart in so many areas, but they just believe this one without any evidence whatsoever.
Yeah, it's unfortunate for our day and age in that we really think we're something special, and that because of technology and our advances in modern science, that we are so much smarter than the ancients. Wow, that's really bad thinking, and it smacks of Vicini in The Princess Bride, you know, where he says, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, idiots, all of them.
Yeah.
Very morons. Yeah, morons, that's right. It's a moron. So it's unfortunate, and it sort of shows a personality that is closed off to learning themselves and is closed off to the investigation. And that's why I say, as an educator, we should keep learning. We should be open to the possibilities there. And a lot of times you find people who are closed-minded, and we got to help them see. We have to help them discover. I use a lot of questions to do this, but discover what it is they believe and how they know that's true and where they're getting that from, in order to help them think well. Because we're just really not a society that is that critical of thinkers, even though we talk about it a lot.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking about how you talk about how you engage these people and such. And one area this gets into is something you said you want to talk about with conversational apologetics. How does this relate to that?
Yeah, I have a very conversational approach. If I can ask you a question when I see something written, rather than tell you, you know, like, this is where you're wrong. I want to do that because again, as an educator, I want to learn alongside you. I want to grow with you, and I want to see you learn about your own beliefs and discover the knowledge for yourself. So it's not me just telling you. It's actually you finding out what you believe. So a lot of times, actually most of the time, when I hear something or I read something on Twitter or Facebook, I'm going to throw a question at you. First of all, I'm going to, like Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason, I'm going to say, what do you mean by that? So I'm not making assumptions, because if I make an assumption about what somebody's saying, I might launch into this long explanation that was not what they originally intended. Also, they may not know what they're saying. They might be repeating a soundbite or an internet meme. I don't know what they know, so I'm going to find out what they know and where it's coming from. That way I can actually minister to them, Nick, and actually, you know, help them discover truth, rather than just it being about me being right and showing off what I know. Now it's moved to being about them, and that's serving that other person and ministering to them.
It's so interesting that you bring up Greg Kokel. He was actually here in Knoxville this past weekend, and I should point out he was on our show on March 23rd last year. And anyway, I said my wife is an apologetics the way I am, but she wanted to go back and hear him again after he spoke. And I think it's because he does it in a way that anyone can do. It's just asking questions. Such, it's not, because if you read his book, Tactics, it's not an apologetics book. You're not going to sit down and say, oh, now I have the answers to so many of the big questions. It's a conversation book.
Right, yeah, and that's sort of my style too. I did with Why Do You Believe That? A Faith Conversation. That's that Bible study I wrote. It sort of does a little bit of both, because I say, in order to be a good conversationalist, you need to know what you're talking about, because that's what people talk about. They talk about the things they're confident in. So in my study, I tried to give 1 week where we looked at just a few basic arguments. And then it spends the other weeks on various aspects of a conversation. And I think the one we fail the most at, and you brought this up earlier, is listening. That's one of the hardest, listening with the intent of understanding the person's view as they understand it is one of the hardest ones for us.
You know, with the Kokor's method, I think I'm thinking also of Mark Mitterberg. He's talking about how he and his wife can go out and do evangelism together. And I thought, yeah, this is the kind of thing that Ali and I would be doing, because his wife is much more of a conversational type and such. I'm not that kind of way. I want to get straight down to the data and start talking about it. And so she'd be talking with someone, and they present a hard question. She says, oh, that's a good question. Mark, do you want to handle this one? And like, yeah, if we went out and did evangelism together, that's exactly how it'd go. But I'd be sitting there just mind my own business, and she'd bring up this question. And the person says, oh, honey, do you want to handle this one for me?
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with having some answers and providing those. That's what we should be doing. That's what we're commanded to do. It's just doing it in a way that is polite, you know, in conversation. Like in our culture, we don't just force stuff on people when they're not interested. So there's a way to have a good conversation. And one of the ways is to earn the trust of the person you're talking to. Do you actually care about that person as a person, no matter if they're Muslim, Hindu, atheist, pagan, whatever? Are you interested in people, right? Because if you're not interested in the person, they're going to pick up on that. And they really, unfortunately, it's not good for argument, but they really don't care what you have to say if you don't care about them. And that's the conversational apologetics approach, is a reminder that we are to love God's creation.
And what do you do in this approach when you meet someone who is just openly hostile with what you believe?
Most of the openly hostile people are the anonymous people online who don't want to own up to their hostility, you know, so they take names they sound like causes or, you know, God is a Jewish zombie, you know, as their handle for Twitter. Those are usually the hostile ones. And in that scenario, I show them that ad hominem is a logical fallacy. It is not good argumentation. So if they want to actually argue something that I've asserted, then they need to do that, and I'll still listen to them. But I'm not going to respond to ad hominem, because that just, it's not even an argument. So I try to show them that in a non-emotional way. I just say, hey, that's ad hominem. Here it is. This is what it looks like. Now here, do you have an argument? Because all I'm seeing is attacks against the Christian faith. One-on-one people are not that hostile, Nick. They're not that hostile because they're right before you. If you're doing, like, street preaching or something and they're really hostile to you, you don't go into a, well, that's, you know, you just violated the law of non-contradiction, and that's poisoning the world, because they may not even know what that stuff is. You have to ask them. So you have to help them see what their argument is. So let me get at, is this what you're saying? Is this your argument? And then they come back to you with the negative wording. And right then, I sort of take the approach of, this is what I do. I'm like, well, you don't need to use all that. That's really negatively charged wording, right? You don't need to use all that. Just tell me what your belief is. Tell me what your argument is. And let me deal with that. I try to be disarming, because I don't know. I don't know why they're angry. You know, I don't know if they were abused by somebody in the church. I don't know if their family, who professed to be Christians and dragged them off the church all the time, if they were horrendous to them, if they experienced sexual abuse, you know, I don't know. So I take the, I don't know where you're coming from or why you're so angry. You really shouldn't be treating me like this, but I'm going to give them a pass on like one or two. And then I'm going to say, you know what, I don't know that we have any conversation going here, because it's just a lot of attack. So that's kind of how I deal with it.
Okay. Well, we're going to go ahead and take our next break. I am Nick Peters. You're listening to the Deeper Waters Podcast, and today we've got Mary Jo Sharp, and we're talking about why apologetics. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyi.org. www.thegrockradioworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'd like to remind everyone that, yes, everything we do here is listener-supported. And every year, specifically, is listener-supported. I don't get paid a penny for doing the show, and I'm not able to pay my guest, such as Mary Jo, a penny for doing the show. Everyone is coming on here of their own free time. Now, if you want to support what I'm doing here and support the work of Deeper Waters and say, hey, I stand by you, I want this to keep going, I want you to have a thriving ministry where there are a number of places you can go to. You can go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com. That's my blog. You'll find the donation tabs there. You can also make donations through tectonics.org, the ministry ministry partners of J.P. Holding, and he takes donations for me. And you can make donations through Risen Jesus and through the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers chapter. Just that each of these people know, hey, I want to support Nick Peters. I want to support Deeper Waters. And also something else you can do now is you can buy the ebook, Christian Answers to This Generation's Questions. JPH and I wrote it together, and it's on the Kindles. It's an ebook. A small portion of all the proceeds will go to Deeper Waters, so I'd appreciate you checking that out and leave us a good positive review. I'd like to know what you think of it. Now, Mary Jo, you have your own ministry. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I have Confident Christianity. It started as a blog, and it just bloomed into a whole ministry of speaking and equipping people in how to defend their beliefs. And I do a lot of speaking, not just at big churches or apologetics events, but I've been doing a lot of speaking even around Texas in smaller churches where they don't necessarily have, like you're saying, you know, the money to bring in these speakers. So we do a lot of encouraging other ministries, because we love to see apologetics ministries get started and get going and get their feet on the ground. And then equipping of the church, doing debates. You mentioned the two that I've done with Muslims. And then, you know, also doing writing studies and contributing to other works in apologetics. So that's basically what we're doing. If you were just to stop me on the street, I'd be saying it's to answer the challenges raised against Christianity and to help the believer gain confidence in what they believe and in defending it. And so you can go to our site right now at maryjosharp.com and check out all the things that we have going there. That's the Confident Christianity side of things. And we also have a donation button there. You have to kind of scroll way down to find it. But we are a nonprofit 501c3, and any contributions you make are tax deductible and goes to supporting all the various activities that we do.
You know, when we talk about why apologetics matters, and you brought up talking at churches, and it really got me thinking about something that I've seen happen way too often, and that's, I've gone to so many churches and said, hey, I'd like to help you out. I'd like to offer you my apologetics ability. I'll be glad to speak. I won't charge you anything. Just let me speak. I'll do a class for you, whatever you need. And so many times the pastors say, we don't really need that right now. Thanks anyway. And I just look around and think, yeah, this is why the church is dying in America.
Yeah, the church has access to and young people as well as older folks. We have access to so much information right now, and a lot of it is bad philosophy. It's all over the place, all over the internet. In fact, a majority of our media portrays our world as secular. It's like J.P. Moreland says, our television shows, movies, and media present a largely secularized view of society. Including the view, he says, that the educationally elite are largely non-religious. Okay, educationally elite are largely non-religious, and that the uneducated are largely evangelical Christians. And what we're seeing is that Christians, like Lewis's statement earlier, C.S. Lewis saying, they're not really argued out of faith, they just sort of fall away. Well, Christians can get into thinking that this isn't true, that there's no God, not because they're argued out of it, but because all of this exposure to bad information. And to think that your church doesn't need to handle this, it's really sort of I don't want to sound like I'm being rude because I don't know individual church reasons. Maybe they've had a bad experience with apologists in the past, but you know, it's almost like sticking your head in the sand and then not acknowledging where our culture has gone and the access that people have to bad philosophy so fast. And as C.S. Lewis also said, well, I'm quoting him a lot today, good philosophy must exist if for no other reason because bad philosophy needs answered. And Nick, we're seeing bad philosophy, not just in our new atheists, not just in our, you know, our internet trolls or our anonymous aggressive people. We're seeing bad philosophy from some of the smartest people in our time. If you allow me to just point out one, which is Stephen Hawking in The Grand Design, one of the greatest physicists of our time, makes a statement. Yeah, that philosophy is dead, right? He makes a philosophical statement. A self-refuting statement, and you got to go, wow, this, and he says science are the torchbearers of truth, and that's paraphrasing, but he can't know that through any method of science. And these are the kinds of things that we need to point out, that we have, you know, we have this, we're living in a time of celebrity culture, and that's not just celebrities we think of like actors. It's also we're putting these guys up that are physicists, you know, as we're idolizing people, and we're putting them up on these platforms like, wow, they're so smart. They must be smart in every single area, and, you know, almost it's almost a cult following. And we gotta train people to understand that an expertise in a field of knowledge or body of knowledge does not make a person automatically the expert across the board. And this kind of thing is affecting the people in our church. It's affecting our youth. They're seeing this and they're thinking, well, to be Christian, I must be an idiot, right? Like you said earlier, I must be ignorant because I look out into my world and I see no Christianity in any sense, in any broad, influential way. So obviously Christianity must be for silly people. It must be a dying thing, an old tradition, which is nice, but not true. And that's why we have to have apologetics in our churches. We need to be able to combat that ideology.
You know, it's interesting you talk about the celebrity culture and the way the media pictures us, because I was immediately thinking about how Matthew McConaughey caused such an uproar with so many people because at the Oscars he actually dared to thank God publicly once he got his rewards. How terrible is that? And, of course, I suspect for you saying people want to go out there and champion tolerance as well.
Yeah, and isn't it interesting? I thought this actually can prove a good point. I'm glad you brought it up. I was watching the Oscars, and so Matthew McConaughey, who's an actor, and in his medium is acting, right? So he gets up there and pulls himself out of his medium and is very real on his personal life and just says, you know, I'm giving God thanks for this. He's apparently not his hero, but anyway, he's looking up to God. But then notice Darling Love, who also won an Academy Award. She gets up there, but because she stays in her medium, which is song, and she praises God in song, she got a raucous applause for her, but she was doing the same thing. Isn't that interesting? It almost shows, I don't know how to say this, you know, on one side of it, I say that when we do our work with excellence, it will, you know, we earn an audience. That's what Darlene Love was doing. But it also makes me think, when we're doing our work intellectually, we're just being open and real about what we believe, look at the reaction to that. Isn't that telling of where we're headed with critical thought?
You know, when we were asking about how all this bad information is out there, the analogy that I've used is that you can have a boy who's 13 or 14. He goes on YouTube because he's going to look at a song from his favorite Christian band. And there on the side of the day of videos, he sees something like 10 contradictions that prove the Bible is not the Word of God, or some fundamentalist atheist video. And just one click is all it takes to get that deconversion process started.
Yeah, it shows us that we're not doing our job in the church as far as educating people on the great Christian faith and the doctrines of what we believe and our history of where we've been, what we've dealt with, and where we've come from. specifically in over the years of Christians, like you said, Justin Martyr's Apology. I mean, they're writing against heresies that seem to be coming up again today, like Gnosticism and things. And our children don't know this. They know Bible stories. They know Jesus is a friend and all of that, but they don't know their traditional faith. They don't know, you know, what's the importance of Jesus in solving or providing an answer, let's say, to the problem of evil. What's the importance of that? Because they're going to face evil in this world. They already face it as children. So what does the Christian faith have to offer? We're not training them in that. And this is vital because they do. They get online and one click away. I've had guys tell me they left the faith on Zeitgeist, the movie. And I want to say, you're kidding me. You're kidding me. Right?
Yeah, I've watched that movie, and my immediate five words was, who do I sue to get these 2 hours of my life back?
Yeah, it was for real. And bad scholarship that's in there.
You know, we're talking about the intellectual difficulties they can correct. Just think about, heck, what's going to happen in their high school and college culture if they live this way? Because first off, Lauren Winter in her book, Real Sex, says that if you get a guy and a girl on the couch together, even though they're both Christians, a few verses from Paul is not going to be enough to stop them from giving in to temptation. And what's going to happen when they go and they get told about the Christian view on such a moral issue is a joke, and where you're just not part of a cool crowd if you're not sleeping around and such. It's a hard issue our youth are going to have to face.
Yeah. Good point, Nick. And they're going to have a philosophy of life that has depth and meaning. And they're going to have something more than just a list of do's and don'ts for their life. They need something that is, like I said, it has depth. You know, what we try to do with our own daughter is we try to point her to that which is true and good and beautiful, you know, which is God. And we try to show her that there is a way to live that is redemptive, and that redemptive life is what does actually do what we were talking about earlier. It does bring you fulfillment in a way that nothing else brings. It is charitable to all people at all times. Like C.S. Lewis said, in dealing with the sex issue, he said it's uncharitable to put somebody in a position that it makes them uncomfortable, right, where they're having to mm-hmm. to go, you know, transgress their values, what they believe. It's uncharitable to do that. So that's the way we focus. But that comes out of developing a worldview of depth, of understanding the presence of evil in this world, of understanding why it is we sin, of understanding that humans have free will, of understanding all of these different things, these aspects of being human, putting that together, the comprehensive view, so that when we send students out, they are more of a whole person rather than a list of do's and don'ts and a very shallow, living a very shallow existence.
When you're talking about this list of do's and don'ts, I remember being in a church service. It was the silver ring thing, which is kind of like true love waits and such. And the pastor was up there giving a talk, and he was saying, now, I want you to know, if you give in beforehand, you're going to be doing this for selfish reasons. I'm like, okay, I can kind of see that, all right. He says, instead we should be asking is, what will I tell my spouse on our wedding night? What if I get pregnant? What if I get an STD? And I'm hearing those, and I'm thinking, excuse me, pastor, those sound like selfish reasons to me as well. And the more he keeps going on and on with all this talking, as I've told someone before, I said, like, I'm a college guy here sitting in the audience hearing a sermon on sex, and I'm getting bored. There is something wrong with this picture.
Oh, man. I didn't have that perspective. That's awesome. Well, you broke down the logic of it, and that's you're right on. You know, the students, by the time they hit around 11 or 12, They have gotten their abstract thinking. They're able to think through these things. We need to hold them to a higher standard of understanding worldview, and so that they can make some sort of sense out of the wholeness of what it means to be human. And I can't, you know, it sounds like I'm talking about spiritual formation. Right. I think apologetics and study is part of transforming individuals spiritually. Right on.
You know, when you were also talking about Stephen Hawking and the educational elite, one statement I like to make is that people say that in the past, the church ruled the world with an iron fist and such, which really they didn't. The Dark Ages is a myth. But
yeah.
I like to point out that today, the scientists are the new priesthood. That if you dare question what an atheistic scientist says, well, you're espousing a vile heresy right now, and we must believe the scientist, and no matter what the field, you always go and look to the scientist.
Right. And an unfortunate problem that is not foreseen by many folks is that science has nothing to tell us about what is good and what is evil. And so anything is allowable in the name of science, as we saw in Nazi Germany with the experiments that went on there. And yet we turn a blind eye to that and just uplift science as Hawking said, the bearer of truth. Well, does that, I mean, where does that leave us as a society for establishing a grounding for good and evil? And then what is allowable in the name of science? Anything? And that's what we have to come to terms with. Science is not a prescriber. It describes. I mean, it can help us forecast. It can help us move on in our technology and better the world medicine-wise, but it's still not going to give us ethical prescriptions.
You know, when we're talking about the way the church goes against apologetics and just tries to ignore it, I tell you, this is what I call the escapist mentality going on, with so many people saying, well, you know, I just don't care. I'm just saying, you know, I'm saved. My children are saved. I'm just going to sit back and wait for Jesus to come. And I'm saying, well, first off, yeah, you might be saved. Good for you. But your children right now, they already are, but who knows what the future holds for them. And this doesn't matter if you're a Calvinist or Arminian, because if you're a Calvinist and these saved children go off to college and lose their faith, they were never saved to begin with. If you're an Arminian, well, they lost it. Or there. So this isn't part of a Calvinist-Arminian thing. But I'm saying they could walk away in faith. And when you're having this escapist mentality, you're ignoring something that Jesus told us to do. But I think it's pretty important, part of the Great Commission.
Yeah, go and make disciples of all nations. Not just get them saved and be good, and I got Jesus and fire insurance. I need to become a disciple. And the scriptures do not leave room for this sort of thinking. Proverbs 4, 6 through 7, and that wisdom is supreme. Therefore, if it costs you everything you have, get an understanding. And notice it's wisdom, not just knowledge, not just salvation, not just sort of knowing Jesus. Wisdom takes gaining the knowledge and putting it into practice. It's a lifelong pattern. And if it costs you all you have, you get wisdom. You don't just sit back on your laurels and say, I got Jesus. That's not in the scriptures. And a more even more condemning passage is Jesus' engagement in Matthew 22 with the religious leaders, in which, and I believe it's the Sadducees, because they're asking about resurrection. And he gives them an answer. Yeah, but he says, "You religious leaders, you do not know the scriptures nor the power of God." He's condemning them. And they are the ones that are supposed to know God, right? And they're good, right? They're doing all the right things. It's a very condemning passage. There's no retirement in Christianity, as my husband and I like to say. You have to carry on, and you don't end. Your mission does not end in this life.
Well, we're going to take another break, and we're going to be wrapping things up when we get back. I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, and my guest, Mary Jo Sharp, will be back after this.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back. My guest is Mary Jo Sharp from Houston Baptist University and of Confident Christianity. And we're talking about why apologetics today. And we've talked a lot about the subject matter, just about where people can go to get more informed. One place I think we should definitely start with is, I've said several times, you're a professor at Houston Baptist University, and that is becoming a great hub now for excellent apologetics resources. Could you tell us about Houston Baptist University?
Yes, I'm very excited to be a part of a program being put together by Dr. Robert Sloan and Dr. John Mark Reynolds. They have organized the School of Christian Thought there at Houston Baptist University, which entails the biblical languages, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. And our apologetics program is brand new as of 2012, and I believe we began taking students in 2013. And so it's our program is a little different in that it's a cultural apologetics approach, which is a Francis Schaeffer, sort of Robbie Zacharias-esque view of apologetics, in which we equip students to use both the rational and the imaginative strategies for apologetics in our time. And to do that, we take sort of an interdisciplinary approach. So our courses involve looking at culture and literature and history and the arts, as well as what, you know, traditionally with the theology, biblical studies, philosophy, those areas. And this program, it's so fantastic. As you said, we have so many great, we have Lee Strobel teaching, Michael Lacona, Nancy Piercy, William Lane Craig just came on board with us as well. He's still at Biola. We're sort of, he's teaching with us as well. And and then I'm teaching there, as well as Holly Ordway, who's done a lot of work in the field of reviving imaginative apologetics, the art of the storytelling about truths of the Christian faith, like C.S.
Lewis. She's been on the show before.
Awesome. Yeah. So.
And, of course, we've had Mike Lacona come on.
Oh, yeah, I would hope so. That's great.
He was a bit suspicious of a host for a while, I think. But
yeah, because you married his daughter. That's right. That's a good dad right there, Nick. But yeah, so this is a really unique and awesome opportunity for people to come. And you know, for me, one of the things that I love about our program is that we don't want to just give you the arguments. We want to help you move into affecting culture, and so that's whatever area that you're coming from. You know, are you a writer, a musician, a scientist, you know, an engineer? What's your background? We want to help you move into using the material effectively. And one of the classes that I'm teaching, actually I have two that I teach. One is spiritual formation. So along the way, we're providing a community for you to grow spiritually through apologetics, like we were describing earlier in the show. You know, how is this affecting you? And then also I teach apologetics and communication, so I'm going to help you with your platform, how to be a better speaker, a better person on social media, you know, how to have a better presence, engaging our culture. And it's a fantastic sort of holistic view of how to affect our society through apologetics. And we have it residential, and starting in the fall, we have it completely online as well.
Excellent. And I've been encouraging a number of people to say, if you want to study apologetics, Houston Baptist is an excellent place to go to.
Well, I appreciate that. We think so, but we're there.
Now, what about the Confident Christianity? What resources do you have?
Awesome. Well, before I do that, I forgot. You know, I just talked about Houston Baptist University, and I didn't give them a URL. I didn't give them a place to go, right? So I'll give them that.
Where to go.
Yeah. hbu.edu/MAA, which stands for Master of Arts in Apologetics. So you can check out our master's degree by visiting hbu.edu/MAA. And then for Confident Christianity, one of the works that I have recently done, I've done a lot in the last 2 years, but one that is really doing well right now is that Why Do You Believe That study. It's going to introduce your church to apologetics, and it can be used with small groups. It is put out by Lifeway Christian Resources. So if your church has been, it was originally, by the way, put for women's groups. It was Lifeway Women that found me and wanted to introduce apologetics into these women's ministries. It can be used for either, but note that the audience in my video is all women. There's a guy back there, but you can't see him. But so you have this, if you have churches that have been used to doing these studies put out by Lifeway, a lot of churches use like a Beth Moore study or Priscilla Shire or whatever, this would be a very familiar format for them because it's a video-driven study, and it's only 7 weeks long, and it introduces them to apologetics, and it gets them active in conversation. Part of the course throws them back out into having conversations with people and then coming back and, you know, engaging with each other and how it went, developing sort of the support system for having better conversations. So that's Why Do You Believe That? I also have a book called – oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go. Tell us your book first.
All right. I've contributed to a couple of apologetics works that are collections of apologetics essays. One is Come Let Us Reason, New Essays in Apologetics, edited by William Lane Craig and Paul Copan. And I've written on the pagan mythology argument, and Jesus is a dying and rising God. And then I wrote in another collection called In Defense of the Bible, a comprehensive apologetic for the authority of Scripture. And again, defending that the Bible does not read like myths. It's not the same thing. And then my own book is Defending the Faith, Apologetics and Women's Ministry, and it's being used as a textbook at seminaries for ministry programs.
You know, you mentioned about how your study is especially for women. I think that's something important to mention because usually in the apologetics field, women are the rare exception. We've had Holly Ordway on the show. We've had Lynn Kohick on the show, but really women seem to be a minority. And thinking back to my time when I was in seminary, which had a strong apologetics focus, women in the classroom were extremely rare. So how is it that you got into this as a woman? Is it different for you as a woman being in a field dominated by men, and why should other women be in this field?
That's a really good question. For me, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I was sort of a tomboy, so I never really noticed, like, wow, I'm a woman, and there's a whole bunch of guys around me. So I'm kind of odd that way. I noticed that I'm a Southern Baptist, and within the Southern Baptist Convention, by the way, don't hold that against me. I'm just making a joke there. But within the Southern Baptist Convention, there's a lot of women's ministries. And they didn't seem to, like you were saying, they didn't seem to have this sort of, didn't seem to have an introduction to apologetics. It wasn't an aversion to it. You know, women want to know how to answer the questions that their kids are asking, you know, or their spouse is asking. And I've had a lot of that, you know, my spouse is starting to doubt what he believes, and I don't know how to talk to him about it. So women want, and for themselves, they have doubts as well. They want to know what the answers are. But they're meeting in these women's ministries, and they didn't have anything for that. And so what Lifeway did was they saw a video series of mine in which I was teaching on, you know, how to have these good conversations. And they saw this as an opportunity to really pull apologetics into all of these well-established women's ministries across the United States. I had never even thought really to do this. I was just teaching apologetics to whoever would have me. And Lifeway, as well as the Southern Baptists of Texas, they saw a need. They have a thriving women's ministry, part of the Southern Baptists of Texas. And the leader there, who was Shirley Moses, she said, "No, I see a need for this within our convention, and I really want to have this for our women." So it was really the other people that had this vision for this, and they brought me on board, and then we were able to write something that was really useful for these ministries in a format that was familiar, and it's creating a desire for more, and that's really awesome to see that. They're wanting, you know, to go deeper. They're reading the resources that are provided there, and they're having these great conversations and defending their beliefs.
So what would you say to women, then, who are thinking, isn't this kind of a man's field? I mean, men are ones who go out there and argue and fight the battles and such, and women just, we're more meek and mild, you know, we just have to just, we're support our husbands, but that's just not a woman's thing now, is it?
Yeah, that goes back to our call to disciples and our call to minister. We're all ministering to people and serving them. And one of the ways we serve them is, and I know we said this already, Nick, but it's a great time to be put a reminder, is to set apart Christ as Lord. Is Christ Lord of your life? If you're professing him as Lord of your life, what does that entail? Well, it entails knowing why you believe in him, why you trust him, why he is worthy of worship, and so that you yourself can be an intellectually honest Christian, that you believe it to be true, and that you start to show that in your own life. And just like I saw with my own daughter, the change that happened to me when she saw me personally holding to an honest belief that there is a real God, and how that was affecting me, it started to affect everybody around me, including my family. So as a woman, first of all, we're given the command by Peter to be prepared to defend why we have hope in God. What's our reasoning for that? That's straight out of Scripture. And then secondly, you can see the effects of this on your own life and how it ministers to the people around you. When you are living as a believer in God, when you're living as a real disciple of the greatest teacher who ever lived, and that's a person who is constantly learning, constantly pressing on towards the deeper knowledge of God.
And I'm guessing that you'd also think that if you're a single woman, you're going to be a better woman as a result of this. If you're a married woman, you're going to be a better spouse as a result of this. And if you're a mother as well, you're going to be a better mother as a result of this.
Good point. It's for anybody. And, you know, when Jesus, going back to Matthew 22, when he said that they're not given in marriage in heaven, answering the question, right, of resurrection and whose wife is this person, there's something that persists into the afterlife that is not related to us as being a mom or a marriage partner. And that is, you know, getting at the basics of who you are as a Christian. Anything you do to improve your Christian part of you, your soul, to get towards what's true and good and beautiful, that will impact you, and it impacts the people around you. As you yourself learn to flourish as a human being, you become attractive to those around you. But for yourself first, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was talking with Ari about this kind of thing yesterday. I said C.S. Lewis would tell us that every single act we do on this earth matters. We are either building ourselves up to be a heavenly person or a hellish person.
Yeah. He said that, I don't remember who it was actually who said this. I recently read that hell had gotten into the person before the person had gotten into hell. I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, you're building, your every act you're doing is an act of transformation. It's either pulling you towards God, pushing you on towards God, or it would be pulling you away from God.
Well, if someone wants to get this DVD series, can you remind us where it is that we can go to get it and maybe how much it costs?
Yes, thank you for asking. You can actually access it online right now, but you can go to lifeway.com, lifeway.com, and then just put in Mary Jo Sharp, and you'll see my resources there. And you'll see the Why Do You Believe That study. You can either buy the whole leader kit, which I believe they sell for right around $100. It's meant to be used with a small group. Or You can buy the videos individually online. I actually don't know how much they are online, individually sold. But then the member kits sell for right at $12.95 each. And, Nick, you'll also see I have another study out, which is a look. It's a look at 1 Peter called Resilient Faith. And if you go to Lifeway and you look me up, you'll see that there as well, which is just walking through 1 Peter. And it's just a great study for a small group at a, you know, just wants to be introduced generally to what Peter's saying about suffering and pain and how that relates to the defense of the faith.
Well, Mary Jo, we're nearing about 5 minutes left. It's been a wonderful conversation we've had with you today. I know you've given it several times already, but if people want to find out more about you and what you do, where do they go again?
Thank you. Yeah, there's two places I will send you. One of them is to my website, which is maryjosharp.com. You can also get there by going to confidentchristianity.com, if that's easier to remember. And then don't forget to check me out over at Houston Baptist University at hbu.edu/MAA. You'll see me there amongst the faculty as well.
Yeah, we've got a little over 4 minutes left. If there is a final message that you'd like to leave with the audience today, what would it be?
I would want to encourage our audience, I said it just a little bit ago, that we're talking about why apologetics, and let me encourage you that when we talk about apologetics, we're not saying that you have to be like where I'm at right now. What we do expect is that part of honoring Christ as the Lord is that we are a people of the book. We're a people of the intellect, of rationality, not just of that, but we are of that. We are made in the image of God with a rational mind. And so we have to feed that mind. And we have to continually do so because we follow the greatest teacher who ever lived. So part of being a disciple of Jesus entails a person who is open to learning the rest of their life. And in fact, a lot of people who use the childlike faith, they say they have a childlike faith, they must remember that in that passage, it is talking about a trust in God when you don't always know what's going on, right? It's trust in God, like a child trusts a parent when they're hurting and they don't understand. But it also, as a, like sort of a side effect of that childlike faith, is that children learn. Children are constant learners. They are inquisitive naturally. They inquire, what is it? Why is it? That's who we are to be as childlike faith. We are to be learners and constant learners, humbly coming before the God who created the universe, the knower of all things, the creator of reality, and acknowledging our place in that, saying we are humble in knowledge because we know we can't know it all. So just where do I start, Lord? And as far as apologetics goes, start with whoever you have to minister to. Who is right before you? Serve them. If you don't have anyone right before you, then start with yourself, right? Because that's always a great place to start. Are you spending the time to know why you believe and what it is that you believe? So when God gives you that opportunity, you'll be ready to give the reason, the defense of the reason for your hope in Jesus Christ as Savior. That's what I want to leave you with.
Well, I'd like to remind everyone that next week, Daryl Bach, like I said, we'll be on, and we'll be talking about Luke and his writings in the New Testament and what a project value they have. But now, I really want to thank Mary Jo Sharp for coming on. I think it's been a great show, and I hope we'll see you back here again sometime.
Nick, I hope so too, and you've been a gracious host, and I really appreciate it.
And for now, I'm signing off, and we will see you next week.